With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So the sweet spot is going to be the MXL at the front there. You can go nice and close.
Like this.
Yeah, man. Let's turn him up a little bit. So I'd like to, if it's okay with you, Christian, begin where all good stories should begin, right at the start, and hear all about where you grew up and your folks and your siblings and your childhood. And we want to go way back. Okay, deal. I'm on airplane mode, so I'm guaranteed to win.
I'm on airplane mode.
Okay, then we're both winners. I'm like 90% vegetarian, and occasionally I'll treat myself to a little bit of meat. I'm not anti-meat. As I said to you earlier, my granddad was a farmer,
right.
So I've been around the meat industry, if you want to call it that,
sure.
For many years, and I think each to their own is my take on it. I feel like I feel healthier for eating less meat.
Yep.
And I think if people don't want to eat meat, that's great. But if they do, then that's also their choice, and that's fine too.
There we go. Matt Pritchard, I know you do tours with. He's a lot more on the ethical side.
He certainly is. But he as well comes from the... because he's super obsessed with exercise and health now. And I think for him, it was a case of turning his life around, because I think he reached a point where he was partying so hard. And I think he said he looked at himself one day on TV and he was all bloated and yellow. And he's like, I'm going to die if I don't make some changes. So now, instead of doing crazy stunts, he's doing triathlons and Ironmans. And
but it was a moment when he was doing half and half, which I really...
That's the craziest part, isn't it?
I was like, wow, you're incredible. Like, you know, because we were kind of sponsoring him when I was at DC, you know, down in Ibiza, and supporting, trying to support him when we could. And I was like, and then next thing you know, 3 days later, he's training for a triathlon. Like, holy crap, dude.
He told me once that he went straight from a crack house to a marathon. After all night out and about doing whatever he was doing, and then straight to the track and ran however many miles.
Oh,
that's insane to me.
Gosh, straight from a crack. who else does that?
No one.
Politicians.
Yeah. So, yourself, where did life begin for you?
Life began for me. My father grew up. Do you remember the TV show Kojak?
Of course.
So my dad's father, my grandpa, who taught me barbecue, he was a bacteriologist in Iowa, Sioux City, Iowa, the birthplace of the Sloppy Joe, or as it used to be called, Loose Meats.
Right, yeah.
Very appetizing sandwich, but it's one staple in Sioux City, Iowa. So I was baptized and grew up in Iowa, and then also I spent the other half of my childhood in Virginia Beach, my mom's side of the family. So my dad was the officer in the Navy, picking up astronauts as they would kind of orbit the Earth. When they would splash down, so he was on deck calling the shots for Gemini 11 splashing down. And then my mother was the beauty queen pageant winner down in Virginia Beach, so she fell in love with the officer.
So it was like an all-American childhood.
All-American. Well, yeah, except for my mom was, you know, backstage with, like, the spinners. And
so she was a proper soul diva, was she?
She was the disco queen of the East Coast. So my mom was at Studio 54.
Wow.
Partying up with Warhol you know, she would dress up as Wonder Woman and sit on men's laps at conventions. And Dad was, you know, Midwest, you know, ROTC, that kind of guy, you know. And then I got kidnapped at the age of, I think, 7. My mom kidnapped me from my father. Then my dad kidnapped me back. And I just kind of was hidden on farms for a while, trying to, my parents fought over my sister and I. And my dad won us in a landmark court case because my dad, my mom wanted full rights. And my dad's like, well, you know, you leave me no recourse, Pam. And he made it look pretty bad on the stand because she was out partying all the time and not really being, you know.
A stay-at-home mom.
So all of a sudden, my dad now had to be a stay-at-home dad. So he changed his career, raised us, like I'm raising my kids. And
what a strange kind of crazy parallel. It's come full circle.
Yeah, well, he's one that you need to get your kids, you know, because I'm divorced, but I'm going through a settlement now, and I've got 2 of the 3 kids. And it's, you know, it's a lot of it's down to how my father raised me. So, yeah, my dad raised me, saw my mom on weekends here and there, and she was really into music. So, you know, we grew up to Hot Rocks and, you know, Talking Book, Toys in the Attic, you know.
That's some of the best records ever made for me. Sick as a Dog off Rocks, yeah, by Aerosmith is one of my all-time favorite songs. And I think of Talking Book, I Believe When I Fall in Love This Time It Will Be Forever, is one of the most beautiful songs ever written.
I was born to Talking Book.
Really?
I was actually DJing at University College Hospital next to the missus and playing Talking Book in between Bach. Just in case. I didn't like want to hear Bach, but I thought it would be soothing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it kept putting me to sleep, so I put it back on Talking Book. You know?
Switch it back to Stevie. So when did you first discover, well, what came first as well, music or skate culture? Or was it two and one of the same?
Yeah, it was, I think it was the same. So I had my first skateboard when I was like 6, metal wheels, then those little banana boards with the little urethane wheels, and then my Uncle Rip, my mom's brother, was like the local surfer, so he, you know, gave me boogie boards and take me surfing and give me better skateboards. So it kind of developed there. And then my stepmom got me really into snowboarding at 85, when I, in 1985, 86. I got my first snowboard. So I remember going out to Jackson Hole, and I think I saw one snowboarder in 10 days. And everybody else just spat at me.
What, because everyone else was a skier?
Yeah. And you had to take tests to go on mountains back in 86, 87. And people just kind of just looked down at you. You were the scourge.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I think people forget now how much of an outlaw sport surfing, skateboarding, snowboarding was. Like punk rock. Like if you had blue hair,
exactly. You
were bad news, basically. You were like a troubled punk.
And now it's just the norm, tattoos and piercings. It's just kind of modern. Yeah, isn't that weird?
It's crazy.
So I was into action sports, more so into snowboarding, but I still skateboard, you know, every couple of days. And then I did a lot of barbecues. My father taught me barbecue at a young age.
So the food's always been there, has it?
Well, it's because he knew barbecue from his dad, and when he got full rights to us, he's like, listen, you need to run the grill, cook these up, I'll do some sides, and then we'll, you know, feed you, me, and your sister. So, you know, I'd be cooking and burning burgers and hot dogs, and every now and then he would give me a steak. He was never dry-aged because he was a greetings card. He was a greeting card salesman for Hallmark. After get this, after Navy, he worked for IBM as a sales guy. Back then, it was like an entire floor of a building that did what a calculator does now. And he quit the day I was born to get a job with Hallmark. I was like, why, Dad? IBM, we'd be rich. Anyway.
Just to do right by his family.
He just wanted to have a more stable job.
Yeah.
Yeah, greeting cards and ornaments and gift wraps sold back then. Computers.
Yeah, not so much. They'll never take off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, hindsight's a wonderful thing. So he, remember one time I was doing a steak, and I think I was like 7 or 8, and I cut the fat off, and he's like, what are you doing? I go, well, I'm going to cut the fat off eventually. He's like, no, that's where the flavor is. And I'm like, oh. And that's where I started understanding how fat is flavor. And then I just started getting more into it and making our TV series Rad, I would have taken a grill on tour. So we would do the skateboarding, snowboarding show for Channel 5.
When did you move to the UK? To backtrack a moment.
So
what brought you over here? Was it your whole family or did you make the career move?
I was making snowboard movies out in Colorado. And I came over here to get distribution. And I was really into the UK music scenes. I was into Manchester. You know, I liked the Happy Mondays and the Smiths and Joy Division. huge Cure head. So I came over here because I think I had Swerve Driver on the soundtrack, and William Orbit did the first track on my first film. So I was coming here to see the musicians and the artists that I work with and go see some live gigs. Met Swerve Driver over at the Island in Ilford. And then got a movie and an album deal with Sony, and ended up doing a music video for Jamiroquai called Light Years. Ended up doing music videos for Reef.
Directing,
and then we got a movie and an album deal through Sony and Columbia, and it just seemed like a good place to kind of base myself. So my other two partners stayed in Vail. We bought a school bus. We traveled in that, but I was kind of bouncing around the world, you know, trying to find money to make the movies and do my bit of filming, and eventually just kind of based myself here. I mean, I was only here about 6 months a year, but then I kind of made myself here more permanently, and then we did that pilot for Channel 5, and we were one of the longest running shows on Channel 5. I think we did 250 episodes, 13 seasons.
I used to grow up watching that show, man. I remember at that time on mainstream TV, there wasn't much, if any, coverage of skate culture at all. Who was the little guy? He'd always have a backpack on.
Oh, Mark Churchill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just found Mark Churchill's 1999 sponsor me tape.
Right, right.
And now he's like the Arnold Palmer of skate parks. So he designs skate parks, builds them, and then demos there, and still a sick skater. I think he just turned 40, which is weird. I remember taking him on road trips when he was 13. You know, it's time flies. I remember your boys Matt Pritchard and Dayton when, you know, they were pro skaters, and we'd be in some rinky dink bar in Birmingham watching people sell packets of ham and radios in the background and drinking dodgy snake bites.
Yeah, yeah. Pritchard
and just,
do you remember the first time you met them? Was it like a monumentous occasion?
You know, just because Pritchard is he's larger than life, but he's just this lovely, lovely, gregarious, loving person. Like, he took me in and would always hang and loved a good conversation. And I knew him at a date just because I was sponsoring, and I kind of invested in 50/50 skateboard shop, Danny Wainwright's shop, and in Bristol, so I'd see Dayton here and there, but it was mainly Pritchard that I hung out with. And then I championed Pritchard versus Dayton, their first, you know, VHS tape. Remember, I invited Dave Carney from Jackass to come over and write an article for Big Brother Skateboard magazine on the band skate team, which I was also managing when I was making my TV show. So from 1996 to 2007, I managed the band skate and snowboard team, produced and presented Rad for Channel 5.
The BAFTA-winning series. Christian's got a BAFTA from that time in his kitchen. I was like, whose is that? Mine, dude. That's so good.
First time Channel 5 ever won a BAFTA. We actually won a BAFTA the same night that Peppa Pig did.
Right.
And we're on the same table as Peppa Pig producers. It was much better if it was Peppa Pig.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd been surreal. And we were the first two BAFTA Channel 5 won because they did a collab with Nickelodeon.
So you kind of had almost like a hand in the birth of Sanchez, then, you could say, in an abstract kind of a way.
Skate tour, I showed him the video and he's like, oh god, these guys scare me. I'm like, really?
Do you remember your reaction to the first time you saw Dan Joyce by the lake shoving the shit in his face? Because that was obviously the scene which kind of took that underground skate tape to the level of notoriety that it reached, wasn't it?
Joyce scared me. I always felt that Pritchard and Dayton, you know, even though they were doing stupid stuff, I just thought Joyce, he had no off switch for what was really, really wrong and disturbing.
Yeah.
And I used to hire Pritchard and Dayton we used to do skateboarding and snowboarding awards ceremonies. They were called the Union Awards, and I would book them with early Cuban Brothers incarnations and Killa Kella. And, you know, I remember one ceremony, I'm rocking 103-degree temperature, you know, barely ready to pass out. And then they put the hook through, I think, Pritchard's ear.
Have you seen their earlobes recently? Both of them are like purple and scar tissued up. Like, they look like they've seen serious damage.
Oh. Yeah, when you're about to pass out from a fever and you're ready to puke, and then you see all the blood fly on stage. then Dayton took an air pistol and shot himself point blank into the balls that night. And remember, we were doing board exit alley pally that weekend. I just kept seeing him outside on doorsteps, doubled over, like the whole weekend. I go, are you okay? He's like, shot myself in the ass, Christian.
Again. Again. Were you at the skate competition where Joycey ran out into the middle of the like floor, gimped up?
Yeah, I was there. That was
because that was one of those legendary moments, right? Because he started going up to all the American skaters and freaking them out.
I was filming it for Channel 5. They had Tony Hawk there. Mark Gonzalez was there. Chad Muska. I mean, it was Mike Vallely. They had a Jaguar in the middle. New Kingdom were playing. Remember that band?
No.
Kind of like fuzzy, dirty hip hop.
Right.
More kind of like early Beastie Boys, and they were the band. And yeah, he did the Gimp outfit. I filmed it. I've got footage of it somewhere.
Have you? Okay. Oh, mate, yeah. We need to tap you up for some of that. We've been showing a lot of unseen clips on this tour. And it's just like a mine of gold. It's crazy, isn't it? Because in this, we were talking about this a moment ago, in the pre-digital, pre-social media, pre-smartphone world, that stuff wasn't accessible. You couldn't just go onto a computer and watch Guy shits in his face or Guy pulls hook out of here. So it was radical, wasn't it, what they were doing? Jackass, Sanchez, CKY, all of that stuff. Was,
everything.
It was so of the moment as well.
All the skate points. Like if you look at Tony Hawk's 900, that's my footage from when we were at X Games in SF. When all this mayhem, the Pappas movie.
Yeah. I love that.
ESPN wouldn't sell them the footage, so they contacted me. Because someone uploaded a clip from Rad when we were at the X Games, and they put it was our footage that Sunset and Vine, who produced our show, is the producer show. You know, that's our 900 that you see forever. It was just hard to get a hold of that stuff. And there was no immediacy. You couldn't just look it up. You had to go to the skateboard shop. You had to buy the video. You had to, like, tune in. Or sit your VCR to record Rad at the time, just to get that kind of niche world.
Yeah,
and that's what you know, Pritchard, Dayton, Jackass, we did with Rad. These are early days, but it's funny. You always think TV's timeless. That's bullshit. YouTube's timeless. I've got a video on there where we built a water wheel. We cooked a whole venison using the power of the river to spin the venison over a live
fire. Wow,
and that's had like 1.4 million views. That's timeless. You know, I'll earn money off that for the rest of my life. I mean, it's micro payments, it's pence, but you know that will earn me money forever. Whilst all the stuff that me and Dayton and Pritchard did,
hours and hours and hours, days.
2,500 episodes. I've produced 3,000 hours of network television. I've produced and presented. I'll never see a dime of it.
Do you own it all?
No.
And that's the problem, isn't it?
That's the problem. That's why I started writing books. I need to go get your copy of my book. Sorry, you did ask me for one, but
that's all good.
Like, there's lots of music references. Like top tracks to Cook Barbecue 2, top albums to Cook Barbecue 2. It's very, you know, that's what DJ Barbecue is about. I know I'm jumping ahead about my new incarnation, but it's about catertainment. Because I think the quickest way to someone's heart is through their stomach and through their ears. And you and I are both huge, huge fans of music. I mean, there's no bigger fan of music than you. And, you know, we celebrate artists and we like to tell the stories. And you know, I love reading biographies. By the way, if you're
the best.
A really good biography.
Go on.
It was authorized and last second it got unauthorized. Life in the Fast Lane, Don Henley.
Okay, perfect.
Seriously, you think
Motley Crue were Hellraisers, right? Yeah.
Eagles. I mean, Eagles, Joe Walsh, he coined the phrase party till you puke. That's from him. Him and the manager of the Eagles would take a chainsaw on tour, and they would get all the keys to, you know, Glenn Frey and Don Henley and all those dudes' rooms, and they would lower the furniture by 3 inches with a chainsaw, put new door frames in. You know, they would take all the higher cars and play bumper cars outside of mall parking lots on a Sunday.
Different level of decadence, isn't it? Because it was before, I think, restriction came in.
Well, there was no social media, so you could do whatever the fuck you want.
You're off the grid. I love that tune that Joe Walsh has on the solo album where the cover, that hugely iconic shot, which must have, how they shot it, I've got no idea, but him in the pool underneath the water with the table floating everywhere, and it's Life's Been Good to Me.
Yeah. Oh, man. Joe Walsh.
That's a jam.
He changed the game because those guys did not move. And Henley was like, it's all about the music. And then, you know, they start hearing the rumblings of this East Coast rocker coming out, working class, you know, coming over and doing these killer live shows, lots of energy. And, you know, they were still killing it for the West Coast, but they were getting, you know, Springsteen was stealing that thunder. So then Walsh joins the band, starts moving around a bit more. And anytime someone moved in the Eagles, the crowds cheered. People want to see some movement, which pissed Henley off. But Glenn Frey liked it because Glenn was playing backing guitar for Bob Seger. out of Detroit. And you know, the reason they all met the Eagles, I know we're talking about the Eagles, but Kenny Rogers was an A&R scout before Country Artist. He discovered Henley out in, I think, Austin, Texas, brought him out to L.A. to make his band big. It didn't work. They were all hanging out at the Troubadour with Jackson Browne and Linda Ronstadt, and the first time they all played together was as a backing band for Linda Ronstadt. That's the first time the Eagles played together.
That's amazing.
We sound good. Let's keep doing this.
I guess the band, same story, isn't it? You're starting out just jamming with Dylan, and then next thing you're one of the biggest bands in the world. What's your take on L.A.? Do you like it?
I like visiting it.
You like visiting?
Yeah, I mean...
Nice place for the weekend.
It is. And I had a lot of friends out of college that went there. And
did you ever live there?
No, but I would go there to find money for snowboard films and skate projects. And there's 11 guys living in a one-bedroom in Hollywood, you know? But now all my friends are, like, quite successful. My friend Christian Hoffman was the editor on Punk'd and Radio 9. One and now Brooklyn 999, and he's doing all those shows. And I go see, you know, Dave Carney from Jackass and his lovely wife Tanya. I love LA because Lady Hawk's out there, so I go visit her, Pip, because I was championing her when we were recording radio. I love going to LA, but you have to drive everywhere, you know.
Yeah,
I like kind of spending more time in Oakland and SF. It's okay, you know. I think I missed not being able to live in New York, but I came to London and Birmingham and the rest of the world.
Early on, we'll talk about Kerrang! In a moment, but early on for you, what were some of the like life-defining shows that you saw? You told me about one a moment ago. Would that be up there?
Life-defining shows?
Yeah. Like gigs that you saw as a kid or a young man that just for you, it's still right there in your retina as some of the most special things you've ever witnessed. What were you studying?
Radio, television, and film.
Right on.
And then with a minor in English and a minor in speech communications. And then a friend of mine said, hey, I'm going to go move out to Colorado and be a ski bum. Why don't you come out? I go, well, I'm going to finish my degree because I've been here for 4 years. I'm going to get it done. Went out there. He had a bed for me and in the Alps. I'm like, I'll be a snowboard bum. I love snowboarding. And then I end up getting a job at a local radio station called K-Ski covering the Gulf War in 1991. So I babysat CNN and read local news, weather reports, and just produced a 10-hour show on Saturday, a 12-hour show on Sunday, and 2 8-hour shows on Monday and Tuesday.
All live, obviously. All live.
But I babysat CNN, so I had a clock, and I would just, you know, come in and out of all the ad breaks and do local news and weather reports and ski reports, which I produced on carts and everything. And I got my taste of radio and did some work for TV. And I always liked music. I was always listening to a lot of indie music at the time. At college, I was DJing at my fraternity house. So I just started going to see bands and, you know, hearing Nirvana for the first time. And I remember going to see Pearl Jam open up for Pumpkins, open up for Peppers, and, you know.
All three on one bill, back to back.
All three on one bill. They, you know, all Pearl Jam had a live out. I think Smashing Pumpkins had I Am the One out off Gish. And then One Hot Minute was the album, which I didn't really like. I know you're a fan. I gave up on them that album, but they came back with, was it By the Way? And then
Californication,
by the way. Two great albums.
Flawless.
So it's funny. Pumpkins upstaged the Peppers, so they fired him. They threw him off the tour and replaced him with a little band from Washington called Nirvana, which went on to do the same thing. But I did at the same arena, Denver McNichols Arena. I went and saw, I was a huge Breeders fan back in the early 90s, so it was Melbourne's Breeders, Nirvana, and I went to see the Breeders, and Nirvana blew me away. What a voice, and then 4 months later,
that was it.
It was over, so I'm very lucky to have been able to witness it all. And what I liked, and then, you know, I got to meet their PR people over here, Bad Moon, Antoine, who's gone to do Arctic Monkeys, he was doing Smashing Pumpkins, Beastie Boys, and I went to go see him when Foo Fighters started, you know, saying these rumblings. And he's like, Christian, there's no tickets for press. You have to buy a ticket. Enemy, Melody Maker, he will not give any press tickets away. I don't have tickets. I have to go buy a ticket. So myself and the bass player from Ash, Mark Hamilton, I think, we just drove down to Yulu and just bought 4 tickets. And I got to see the very first Foo Fighters gig.
The first one.
The first one on European soil.
Wow.
Yeah. I think Gutter Mouth opened up for him.
Guttermouth. They just played Slam Dunk Festival that I was on. That singer is a wild, wild man.
Yeah.
Wow.
He sold out 7 nights in a row at the Cap Center. And I went the last night, and I was on the floor. My friend's parents waited out overnight, got us floor tickets, and played 3 hours. And I almost caught the pick on the Purple Rain solo. I dove, missed it by 2 inches. It might have been 2 foot, but it felt like 2 inches.
Well, I think that's, for me, what I loved about growing up in a household of music as well, is you loved everything from the Jackson 5 to Prince to Madonna, to Led Zeppelin, to The Doors. Like, it was just all there, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, it's funny, I didn't really appreciate Madonna until much later. I really didn't like pop music. I mean, I think you kind of went through that a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Anti-pop, robot, rock.
Alternative,
metal,
yeah.
Alternative music, and I was one of those guys, and then I stopped being precious, and I was like, you know what? Holiday's a fucking banging tune. Then I went through my old record box.
I think it's in the hall on the stairwell, right?
No, dude, here, no. Stay right there. This is my old record box.
Props, people.
When I was a kid.
What was the first record you ever bought, you remember?
Yeah. Me and Bobby McGee.
Is it really?
Me and Bobby Janis. McGee. Janis Joplin. That was my first record I ever got.
So he's got a little 7-inch box here, people.
Wow, Herb Albert, Donna Summer.
Oh, you've even got a list of what's in there. Loads of ELO.
Peter Gabriel, Games Without Frontiers. Rosington Collins Band. That was the records of Lynyrd Skynyrd, Cool and the Gang. Yeah. Chuck Brown, The Soul Searchers. Bustin' Loose said that's DC Go-Go. That's the sample from It's Hot in Here.
Now, right, yeah.
That's the sample.
I love that Dave Grohl covered that when he did the Sound City documentary series. He got all into the Go-Go stuff. And
yeah,
like,
you know he's from there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's from Virginia, and you know, we would see... Was it Wool, his first band, or Scream?
Scream, I think, yep.
So we would see those guys at the 930 Club.
Were you ever into the hardcore stuff that was going on? Minor Threat and Bad Brains, any of that? Or was that slightly before your time?
No, I mean, that was my time, because I went to high school with the guy in Flem, and Flem would open up for Black Flag. And I had a lot of friends in the DRI and Government Issue and Jody Foster's Army. So I listened to it, yeah, but I was really into hip-hop and rap. Back
right.
Then it was just called rap, so I was going to the Cap Center to see these 9-band rap go-go shows. So a young little kid comes out, he's like 15, called LL Cool J, and then Chuck Brown, and then Run DMC, and Dougie Fresh and the Get Fresh.
And you saw all of that as it was breaking.
That was the beginning of it. That was like, you know, 80, 82, 83, 84, and then Purple Rain. So I was really into, you know.
Black music, black basically, music, yeah.
But then when I got to college, I went into alternative.
Yeah.
Really funny, my oldest son now, Blue, he's got a hardcore punk band, and he's turning me on to stuff I didn't know about. Like, he's so into like early Black Flag before Henry Rollins, now in and then with Henry Rollins. And I'm like, well, you know, check out Circle Jerks. He's really into Circle Jerks, Minor Threat, you know, Fugazi, because they're all from DC.
Yeah,
so it's funny now. I'm kind of getting back into it, but I just wish he wouldn't play it at 10 in the morning.
Yeah, you want to, you know, gently start the day, don't you? So Kerrang, how does that chapter in your life start? Because I never knew you had background in radio. For me, when I kind of first just got involved in radio and was in a radio studio and saw how it all worked, I fully fell in love with the medium. I don't know whether you had a similar thing, like the thrill that live radio gives you is a very unique buzz, isn't it?
You couldn't have said it any better. I one thing I miss these days is I miss radio. Because Colorado, you know, I produced my own show, and you know, and after doing news, which kind of sucked, but you have to earn your way in.
Of course, yeah.
When the war was over, they made me a music disc jockey. Only problem was the station I was on switched back to 24/7 country. I think I lasted 1 week. I was like, "That's Patricia Berg. That's Garth Brooks. I'm much too young to be this damn old on 104.7 99.3 K Ski. You're in the heart of it, Ski Country, K Ski."
And then, that's ingrained in your brain.
Oh, well, you know all the guys. Yeah. So then I went out to the East Coast and just started FM was playing the classics in today's best rock, 104.7, 99.3 KSK. And they brought me back out, graveyard shift. But you got to work your way in. So midnight till 6 or 2 till 8, these 6-hour ungodly shows. You know, I remember 3 o'clock, I would just play Dark Side of the Moon. You know, for the
whole would you get to choose all the music or would it be playlisted?
You had a clock. But you had to pick.
You have your free picks.
Songs with a no, the 3-week no repeat rule. Can you guess what two seminal songs just would get played too much when you had to put a no repeat rule?
Are they of that era or just of all time?
Of all time.
American?
American? New York? Atlanta? It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Only two songs in our entire library that had a 3-week no repeat.
Bryan Adams? No.
Walk on the Wild Side. And Rock Lobster.
Really?
But if it wasn't
for the B-52s rule, man.
If it wasn't for the B-52s, you would not have had the entire really alternative Athens scene, which gave us R.E.M., which was the birth of real alternative music. You know, early R.E.M., Murmur, Light Switch Pageant. I mean, that was...
Document, killer. Reckoning.
Oh, my God. Document and Reckoning? Jesus Christ. And you talk, you hear Stipe like, we're only here because the B-52s paved the way. And, you know, 52 Girls, you know, what a killer tune. But that album, 1979, Boys Don't Cry, 1979.
You know, Devo, Q Are We Not Men, A, We Are Devo.
70s,
it's crazy, isn't it?
That's 83 to 86. And I'm like, you're still in the wrong decade, my friend.
79. What a year for music. And, I mean, for me... That whole New York scene, obviously some bands came from just outside, like the Cramps or whatever, but the fact that in New York, within the space of, say, 2 years, hip-hop, disco, and punk was all born,
sure.
Which went on to then dominate all modern music.
New York and DC, right? Yeah, you gotta give DC.
It's crazy.
Go-go and hip-hop as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And hardcore, but New York was rap, was, a lot of the... I mean, New York was everything.
Yeah. Did you live in New York at all?
No.
No?
You know, it's funny, you had the New York scene, the DC scene, but New York kind of stole everything. And then the California hip-hop scene started happening. But then you had the Midwest. I mean, you had this young kid called Kid Rock, who was shit-hot mixer, you know and he's going on tour with Ice Cube, but he's playing Bob Seger tapes in this tour bus, getting yelled at by all the, you know, NWA lot. And it's just funny watching these early scenes, but for these scenes to burgeon and to blossom, it just must have been such a wonderful time to watch. I mean, I was there for the DC scene to blow. I mean, I was in a B-boy crew called, the Pop Platoon.
Love it.
So this is like 82, 83. I was Sergeant Short. There was Lieutenant Love, Corporal Crush, and Private Pop Alive. We would do battles against the IBM crew and Crazy Legs down at Chuck E. Cheese. So I was all into that. But as soon as I got to the university, it all went. Because you're trying to impress girls to be cool. We had, you know, it was the skaters alternative scene. So Susie and the Banshees. And,
yeah, all the goth kind of stuff, was it?
I was really into Mission and Psychedelic Furs. And, you know,
Sisters of Mercy.
Oh, I got all into that. You know, I love my goth. And that was, and then I remember calling in sick and just following The Cure around on the Disintegration Tour. So
what an album.
Last weekend, and they opened up a plane song off.
Oh, really?
That was beautiful.
Dude, who was your first ever interview? Do you remember?
I would write numerous bands letters. I would always write, you know, Buffalo Tom and early incarnations of Wilco, which were Uncle Tupelo, and the drummer from Uncle Tupelo wrote me a letter back, and I was like, wow, he actually wrote me back. I think it might be like Spin Doctors.
Love it.
So they were touring with the Wallflowers.
Right, okay. Jacob Dylan.
And we went to Denver to go see him, and I remember the Wallflowers, we had nowhere to stay, so they just let us crash on their floor. You know, the guitarist of the Wallflowers, just end up just drinking all night with them and Spin Doctors. Super nice guys.
How did you first meet Reef? Because you did quite a lot of work with them, right?
Yeah, I was.
How good that they're back as well.
It's great. Chad, it's funny, the bass player called me the other day to check on some stuff. It was because I got signed to Sony, ended up using a band called Swerve Driver, which were on Creation at the time on my first film, Blindside, snowboard movie. and the manager had just signed a band called Reefs when I went out to call to Portugal just to be a, you know, be a bum for the summer after getting distribution rights for my first film. He started sending little cassette singles for Good Feeling, and I'd be on a little beach with my Walkman listening, oh, this is good. So came back, met them, started directing some music videos for them, and used Feed Me as the opening track on our second film.
Didn't you do a documentary with them as well?
I did a lot of filming with them, and I went on tour with them in the first two tours. We did all the little, the Driftwood,
yeah, yeah,
St. Agnes or St. Ives and all those kind of small venues, and I went to, you know, Reading and Phoenix and, yeah, all that stuff. So yeah, we used to go surfing and skating together. They're good friends, yeah. Gary's got a flat in Camberwell, so he'll come over for a cookout.
Nice.
We for good-hearted boys.
He just did a track with Skindred as well on their latest album. He did a guest vocal spot. What an unlikely combination, but it worked.
Yeah, I love Skindred. I don't think people realize how super incredibly popular that Skindred still is. They, you know, Dan Pugsley and Benji and all those guys.
In the live environment, they crush. They're one of those bands that are incapable of doing a bad show.
That's right.
Like, if you go to a Skindred gig, you are guaranteed to have the best night ever. Every time.
Nicest guys ever.
Yep.
Because I got to host the Metal Hammer Golden God Awards for Scuzz.
So you're backstage getting everyone after they come off stage and doing interviews with the winners. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, we're on the red carpet, you know, interviewing, you know, I remember interviewing Alice Cooper. I'm like, dude, I was DJing to 5,000 people at Grass Pop, you know. I had Marilyn Manson headlining, Slipknot headlining, and I tried to fill a field with 5,000 people, and I was playing all these big hits, and I was just stumbling for something to play, and I went to Poison, and it just saved my ass. He's like, I was like, so thank you for recording Poison. And Alice Cooper's like, I got an interesting fact for you. Did you know that Poison is the most played song and the most popular song in strip joints in America?
Has to be, doesn't it? I'd say either that or Pour Some Sugar. It would have to be between those two.
Which is funny, because Joe Elliott was the only person I lost the ability to speak. So I was trying to interview him at Metal Hammer Golden God Awards, and I was like, oh my fucking God, it's Joe Elliott. And I just lost the ability to speak.
That's not like you.
My favorite story, I was interviewing Scott Gorham from Thin Lizzy. And after the interview, he's a larger than life man, Gorham. And he's like, hey man, where are you from? I go, I'm from Washington, D.C. And he starts telling a story about them playing in D.C. And I was like, and he tells a story about, he was like, I was on top of the speaker stacks, and I jump off, you know, I jump about 8 foot down, the guitar goes one way, my body goes the other, and then my kneecap flies off about 10 feet into the crowd. And, of course, they had to stop the gig and pull me off because I've just destroyed my knee, and, you know, I get put in the ambulance, taken down to this hospital. But luckily for me, an assassination attempt went down that day. I was like, what? He's like, yeah. The Ronald Reagan assassination attempt was that day, so they flew every top surgeon in America to that hospital to just for whatever was wrong with Reagan to work on him. So a lot of doctors were sitting around and twiddling their thumbs. So Gorham got like four of the best knee surgeons ever to work on him because they were like just stoked because they had something to do because they're not, you know, they weren't required on Reagan. And he got the best surgeons in America to fix up his knee.
Amazing. Right, like, right place, right time.
Right place, right time. And after he told me, so I was like, we just put away our camera gear. I was like, can we record that, please? Because that's a great story. He's like, yeah, get it out. Let's do it.
You got it?
We got it.
Love it.
But you know,
always got your director's head on. I like that.
You a lot of times, you warm them up. You warm the artist up, and they might be a bit guarded. And then once you're putting all the stuff away, they start giving you all the gold.
I've had that so many times.
Chris Martin from Coldplay. You know, it's so many times. I mean, do you have a story where you got the best stuff as soon as you turn the camera off?
Me,
with the microphone off?
There's several, but the main one that comes to mind is me and Johnny Doom went to interview Rob Zombie. And Johnny interviewed him, I interviewed him, and both those interviewers were fairly average, and he wasn't really given anything like exciting up. And then we started packing away, and then we start talking about Tim Burton and Ed Wood. And he just goes off for like 20 minutes about how much he loves that film and he loves Tim Burton. And at the end of like the chat, he's like, do you guys want me to dedicate a song to you tonight at the show? So me and Johnny are like, yeah, play What? Which is off the Hellbilly Deluxe 2 album. And he's like, damn, we haven't been playing that song. I'll have a word with Joey Jordison, who's drumming at the time. He'll learn it real quick. We'll play it tonight. And then that night he came and was like, this is for Matt and Johnny from Kerrang. Just went into it. But it was exactly one of those moments where I was like, this should have been the interview.
Yeah.
Just 20 minutes about Ed Wood.
Oh, I have been Kerrang. I'd have like guys who will pile up and as soon as the interview was done, they would go, "Hey, are you the guy from Rad?" And I go, "Yeah." They go, they start hitting, "I told you it was him. I told you." And they get all excited. I go, "Was that what you were trying to figure out the whole time we were interviewing? Was if I was the guy from Rad?" They go, "Yeah, we just weren't too sure. You look familiar." And I go, "Can we now do the interview now that we've gotten that out of the way?" And they go, and then all of a sudden, it was like,
they give up the goods. It's crazy, isn't it? I think with a lot of young bands, it's nerves. And then I think also with a lot of more seasoned pros, is just like they're so tired of interviewing that they don't know that they're sitting on this gold a lot of the time.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like people like Alice Cooper are very self-aware.
He's one of the best. He always gives the good. But I interviewed Lawrence Fishburne on the Matrix press junket.
Right, wow. What was that for?
So I had a show called CNX with Ed Lee, who now does Ski Sunday and the Olympics, big broadcaster in sports. So Ed and I kind of, honed our skills together as live MCs and DJs and, Board X to big skate events and, what was I talking about?
Lawrence Fishburne.
So we were at the press junket. So he got to interview Keanu Reeves, and I got Bruckheimer and Pachetta Pickett-Smith and Lawrence Fishburne, and he got Agent Smith as well.
Oh, man. Hugo Weaving.
Hugo Weaving and Ed's there in the press junket. So
he was fairly unknown at that point, though, wasn't he? I think all he'd done was the Priscilla Queen of the Desert film.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, no, he was.
Because it was before Lord of the Rings, wasn't it?
And Fishburne would answer my questions before I asked them. I'd be like halfway through the question, and he just started answering it. He didn't care. And I'm like, what kind of need the answer?
It's got to be clean, Larry. It's got to be clean.
Yeah, but you can't tell him. Anyway, so we're on the red carpet, and Hugo Weaving comes by, and asked him one more question. He's like, "Where did you get that weird way of talking in the movie? Because you play a program." And he goes, "It's really interesting you asked that, because no one's asked that."
It's a great question.
He said, "I got it from watching news readers, because they're reading auto cue and sometimes they just go at the wrong end of the inflection. They'll come up when they should come up."
Like Anchorman shit.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
And he's Aussie, so they come up anyway.
Yeah.
So he just made sure he got it all kind of wrong, because you're a program. When do you come up or when do you come down? It was always a bit mysterious the way he finished sentences. It just kind of sounded a bit off. And I think he really appreciated that question, because he worked hard just watching news readers, especially when they got it wrong.
And no one picked it up till then.
Till Ed Lee picked it up.
He's done incredibly well for himself. So for you, when you were sort of doing the live MC compare gigs, what are some of the big kind of events that you hosted that stand out?
Oh man, we got the world record for air guitar for Guinness. So we were launching Brutal Legend, that heavy metal game with Jack Black.
Alfred
and Rita Ford and Ozzy Osbourne at a Download. So I was the host. I think I wore a cape and Speedos and I don't know. And we had 450 people play air guitar to Ace of Spades, Motorhead. We had the Guinness World Record. So I hosted that. We would do big sound systems in the campgrounds to 3,000 people at Download, 5,000 at Grass Pop. Those are big.
I said earlier on about radio being one of the biggest rushes. For me, the only one that tops it, and it's light radio, but you can actually see the audience there in front of you, and that's why I love doing these live Q&As, is live hosting is such a rush.
Dude, any kind of live hosting, you get to do Dirty Sanchez, and it's just, I think the live stuff's better because you get the immediacy.
Yep.
Seeing if it works or not. In radio, you don't know if they like it or not, so it's quite nerve-wracking having that silence on the end. But it does feel great. It's a buzz. What do you prefer, radio or live?
I have not done radio for so long that I've almost forgotten what it's like, Christian. But for me, I prefer the presenting experience of being live on stage. But what I love about radio and what I desperately miss about radio is the creativity involved with the production. And there's an art form to audio, isn't there? And people like Alex Baker, and I guess even before him, the fucking king of all of it, Tim Shaw. Like, a wizard.
And production and stuff. Kerrang was. That's why I won 2 Sony Awards.
Amen.
It was funny. That's when I knew things were going bad. I was like, we just won a Sony Award. We just beat the BBC. And why aren't we celebrating? Little did we know at our station that some sales guy was embezzling money from Carpet World. And that was it. And that was kind of the beginning of the end.
Beginning of the end.
Kerrang, which just won his second Sony Award.
But it was a great station to work for. We had a great time over there. And
how did you get involved there? I think I asked you earlier, but we never quite explored it.
10 years, and then it finished, and I finished RAD. I finished my van stint. So all of a sudden, I just had my third kid, and I had no income. And I got offered. I did a voiceover for Carl Pinkerton at XFM.
Yeah, yeah.
And Carl says, "Hey, you know what? You should do a pilot for XFM. We're about to lose a big personality." And the thing about Americans is they can get excited about music without sounding like a knob.
Sounds like, insincere. You're like, yeah, stop ramming it down my throat, dude. Yeah, yeah.
Like a knob. And yeah. Oh, you're losing Zane Lowe. Oh, I didn't say that. I know he's going to Radio 1. So basically, they're trying to find someone to fill Zane's boots. So I did a pilot for them, and it just didn't get picked up. But Kerrang got a hold of it and picked me up for the evening show. So they asked Laws to produce it and me to present it. And Laws was like, well, can I host it with them? And that's how Laws got more on the mic. And we did the evening show. And we were actually our first, I think, half year there. We were getting more listening figures than the Breakfast Show.
Wow.
Which is weird.
What an unlikely combination of people as well. Yin and yang, isn't it?
Well, I had no money, and I had an expensive house because I was making TV money. So I basically slept on Laws's floor, and he wouldn't put the heat on.
That sounds like Laws. Love you, Laws. He was so supportive to me. Like, he let me have free reign really with the music on my show. He put the trust and faith in my hands, and it got to a point where he sort of passed over a lot of the guest booking to me as well, and allowed me to build my own contact pool. And he was like a really, well, everybody there to me, because I was that little bit younger than everyone else. I was 24 when I started hosting the evening show. It was my first gig, really, in radio. Like, I'd done cover on Kerrang for 8 months or so, and I'd helped Henry. And then he got married, and he decided he wanted his evenings free because he wanted to be with his wife. So he moved to, I can't remember where he went straight after Kerrang. Yeah.
Yeah, he was doing Capital Extra.
And then I took over the evening show, and it was my first, like, national radio gig with that show. And I was like, fuck.
It's, show.
It's the best.
Yeah.
What year were you doing it? What year, Yep.
And then I think I programmed 8 hours of television on Saturday night. So I programmed Tim Woolworth's show. I hosted a show called Deep Cuts. And I also did a top 40 show.
Yeah, yeah.
Top 40 rock show. So I had three specialty shows. Two I presented, and all three I programmed. Apart from the rock show, the hit show. So, yeah, I mean, I was doing a lot. And then, but I was so into new music. I really was trying to bring in the alternative element, because we were getting playlisted with Scouting for Girls, which suck. Dog's Eggs, you know, Pigeon Detectives, all this kind of twee crap. I was like, why is this song Kerrang? You know, if we're going to play anything, you know, indie and alternative, let's play Friendly Fires, because those guys have a bit of shoegaze in there, you know, fusion of guitars. You know, let's play some more kind of stuff like that if we're going to go that way. But we were the first station to play Cage the Elephant, you know.
Yeah. Silversome Pickups was a band you used to champion a lot, right?
Kings of Leon, I was playing them really early.
Kasabian over there, I've just seen there's a signed, was it Gold record of their first album? So you must have interviewed a lot of those guys at the very early stages in their career, right?
MGMT, we're the first to play them. We championed them when they played the Academy, the Bar Academy.
Academy 3.
Yeah,
the time.
Upside down, you know, poured himself his own beer, and then sent him back, and then took him to Action Submission and party with him all night. You know, those are the days, and now they won an Emmy. No, they won a Grammy, didn't they?
And they've got like 2 million followers all over social media. And Juliette Lewis does a lot of stuff with them. She plays with them, and
she sucked face with me in Madrid.
Really?
I was on a plane with her. I hosted a plane with the Rebel X Fighters for Rebel. I was hosting this plane with all these VIPs, and I see this woman jumping over seats, and I'm like, she's boisterous. And then she pops next to me, just flies over her seats, and he's like, where are you from? I go, Maryland. He's like, hey, my guitar's from Maryland. Ollie, come here, this guy's from Maryland. And then she was performing with Dirty Sanchez.
Really? On stage. It's all coming together.
And then she came off stage right before her encore, just planted the biggest kiss on my lips. I was like, thanks.
Mallory Knox. I interviewed her. She's a live wire, isn't she?
Yeah.
Live wire. She goes out of Brad Wilk now from Rage Against the Machine.
Does she?
Yeah, yeah.
She was married to Steve. She was married to that pro skater who was into Scientology.
Yeah, I think she still is very much in that world. There you go. Yeah.
On the evening show, they had the head of Scientology on, and I was doing a thing on one of my shows called.
Not live in the studio, surely.
They had him live on the studio.
So wow.
I was doing My Name Is Earl moments where I would play one song a show for My Name Is Earl, because it was always a good soundtrack. I get to play standard and stuff like that, some honky tonk, and when I found out the entire cast were Scientologists, and of course we need Tom Cruise, but Beck, I love Beck. My favorite video of all time on YouTube is Beck Reimagining Sound and Vision by David Bowie. If you're listening to anybody, just go onto YouTube. Don't listen to any more of this interview.
Now, come back.
Come back.
Interlude.
Yeah, go watch that video when you have time. We were just finishing our show. I was doing the handover. And I said to the guy, it might have been a pre-record, you're right. It might have been pre-record before we went on, you're right. And he said, you've got all the good ones. What am I missing out on? Please sell me on Scientology. But yeah, he just looked at me and knew there was no way he could have broke me. Because he couldn't.
It's a crazy world, isn't it? Did you watch the Louis Theroux film?
Yeah.
I think from a stylistic point of view, I didn't like the format as much as his TV shows, if that makes sense. I just didn't think it kind of like suited his style as well. But what a bold and brave man to go into that world. How are we looking? Is it almost chicken time? Cool. Alrighty. DJ Barbecue living up to his name. Speaking of big balls, you mentioned the other day about interviewing someone who said to you that Sacha Baron Cohen has the biggest balls in Hollywood. Who is that?
No, I said it wasn't Sacha Baron Cohen, because I've got the biggest balls in
Hollywood. It's true, people. I'm looking at him.
My nickname was Elephant Nuts in college. So this is a very embarrassing story. So Haldor Helgeson, who was probably top three best snowboarder in the world on Nike, lives in Monaco. Only 2,000 people live in Monaco. We're getting hammered at some monster event. I'm DJing some dance party with all the monster girls. And we were having a ball off. I got the biggest balls ever. They used to call me Elephant Nuts. He's like, I got old man balls. Next thing you know, he's like, you're going to do a shot out of the bird bath. I'm like, what the hell is a bird bath? And because I had a pint of Grey Goose vodka, next thing I'm on my knees doing monster and Grey Goose out of his bird bath.
Even the dog looks disappointed in you.
Then everybody's like making fun of me the next day. You did a shot out of Haldor Helgeson's ball sack. Next night, there's a queue of all the top athletes and musicians all doing shots out of Haldor, because everybody loves Haldor. Icelandic. He's just this larger-than-life character. He got thrown off the Icelandic snowboard team because he was involved in some snowboard video that had a bit of naughtiness in it, like a Dirty Sanchez-type video. So Iceland kicked him off the team.
Wow.
I was like, you shouldn't be bummed about that. He's like, I'm not, but my grandma was. Fair enough.
Now have another shot.
I didn't feel so bad because he was actually doing it in the nightclub. He forego the bathroom, and he had a queue of about 12 people doing shots out of his ball sack in the middle of the nightclub, and the bouncer's like, Haldor, you have to stop serving shots out of your balls.
You see, stuff like that, I don't know whether that would happen anymore, because everyone now has a smartphone. Everyone would be filming it.
Yeah.
It'll be all over YouTube or Facebook.
Right, this is like right kind of at the beginning of iPhones, and the batteries never really last anyway, so you wouldn't be able to film it, and the cameras were pretty bad on the iPhone.
It's changed the whole partying game, I feel.
Yeah, so you can't.
You got to just batten down the hatches, haven't you?
To be around, because my friend lives near Robert Plant, and he hangs out with Robert, and they drink together. And I go, what's it like going to the local pub of Robert Plant? He's like, he loves to tell stories of old. He loves to buy around. He just likes to share stories and play local bars. And I'm like, God, I just want your life. So I could just every now and then have that moment of just settling up at a bar and hearing old Zeppelin stories, because they could get away with just debauchery.
Yeah.
And it was debauchery.
It, like, ancient days of Rome style.
that's why you and I like reading biographies and autobiographies, because, you know, the Marilyn Manson one I read, of course we've all read The Dirt, the Eagles, you know, I love these. You know, I bought the Keith Richards one, which I'm meaning to read.
Life.
Yeah, that's the
it's good.
It's up there somewhere. I've got a ton of books I've got to get through. I might even have the Eagles one I can loan you.
Nice, killer. You got to read the NoFX one. I'll loan you that.
I love NoFX. They were my very first film soundtrack.
Were they really?
I Trash Two Heaves and a Bean.
Remember that album? That's my favorite NoFX album.
It is my favorite.
Straight Edge, Bob, Sticking in My Eye, Liza and Louise.
Was the first track on the movie that made me make snowboard films. So I made snowboard films from 1993 to 1997. And a movie called Roadkill came out by Fall Line Films. Dave Cioni directed it. And it opened up with Sticking in My Eye.
Ding, ding, diddle, ding, ding, diddle, ding, ding.
So we used the Bugly Eyes for our slam section, and I forgot what other track we used. But because Epitaph would just give us their entire catalog. Mr. Brett just gave us the catalog. You know, use what you want. Next thing you know, I'm actually teaching Bad Religion how to snowboard when I was hosting MTV. So I was on the mountain the day before the mountain opened with Bad Religion, and I think their guitarist was the kid that was from Circle Jerks.
Yeah.
He joined Bad Religion, I think, because Mr. Brett went off to, you know, run the label and stuff like that. But he would just give you everything. You know, Homesick, Pennywise, you know, all the early, you know, Offspring stuff.
Offspring, yeah. Smash was Epitaph, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. We used Nitro off that. We had Ignition, you know, off the first album. We used all those tracks on our first film. He's like, use what you want. Don't worry about signing anything. Just take it. And
golden days.
Delicious vinyl. They gave us, you know, passing me. Who's it? Passing me by, guys. Far Side.
Things keep on passing me by.
Some of the earlier shit, just because those labels knew that kind of
exposure.
Yeah, because
that was the pre-internet exposure for.
How do you find cool music?
Snowboard videos, skate videos, BMX videos. That was my introduction to so many bands of that alternative era. Be it punk rock or hip hop.
Exactly.
It was all in there, wasn't it?
Yeah, man, Bad Religion, Recipe for Hate, what a great album.
And the games. Didn't you soundtrack a couple of computer games as well?
Dirt. Yeah, so I did here, put this down.
Pull them down.
Dirt 2, Dirt 3.
So would you be like executive producer?
Yeah. I exec produced the soundtracks and I was main voice actor.
You like a radio host within the game, like,
yeah,
Grand Theft Auto style? Let me give you that.
Check out the soundtrack. Like, you'll be impressed with my soundtrack.
How'd you get a gig like that? Were you on Kerrang at that time?
So I had a buddy. I used to be the team manager for PlayStation. And a buddy of mine was at PlayStation, the Sony at the time. And he left to work for Codemasters. Here we go. Check out this soundtrack, bro. I'm very proud of the soundtrack. I did soundtracks for all my snowboard films, for Rad. And then... So he says, Christian, I want one of your snowboard movie vibes. I want the voice, I want the music, I want the energy, I want that alternative vibe. So we've got everything from Biffy Clyro, we have Mountains on there, Black Flesh, Jeremy Kyle is a marked man, I remember that song, Block Party Helicopter, you know, Talons, who else? There's some good stuff in here. Hope and Hell, Glamour of the Kill, Lovesick, Friendly Fires, In the Hospital, Franz Ferdinand, Ulysses, Grounds for Divorce, Elbow, Wanna Be in L.A., Eagles of Death Metal.
That's my jam.
Around the World, you know, Dinosaur Pileup, My Delirium, Lady Hawk, Medina Lake.
So you're pulling off basically what would have been a lot of the evening show music at that time on Kerrang, right?
Queens of the Stone Age, you know, Little Sister, Rise Against, Injection. I mean, those are big songs. Say Aha, Santa Gold. They Say, you know, Scars on Broadway.
Yeah, I love that song.
Bumpin' Steadler, I used to love Steadler. White Denim's on here. Templeton Pack hooked up our friends.
Nice.
Men's Knees by the Cribs is on here.
Yeah, yeah.
Silver Sun Pickups, The Watchmen, The Rat I got on there.
That's a big tune.
The Rakes, Lost Weekend by The Chemist, Warriors Dance, The Prodigy. You know,
that would be one of my dream gigs, I think, like soundtracking, TV shows, soundtrack in film, soundtrack in computer games.
Yeah, I loved it.
What a fun thing
Stone
to
Roses,
do.
This is the one. I got that.
Really?
Yeah.
Full version.
Full version.
Dun, 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 dun.
So I did those games. So I did a lot of voice acting with Travis Pastrana, Dave Mara, you know, RIP, Ken Block, and they were great. And it's funny. One time I was at the Q Awards covering it for Kerrang Radio, and I'm on the red carpet, and I could see Alex Turner walking down. So he's playing disaffected rock star. So I was like, I'm not gonna even try
engage. Yeah.
So I turn around and just put my microphone over there if I call something, and he's coming down the red carpet and he's scratching his head, blowing off all the interviewers, and then he just kind of sees me. He's like, where do I know you? And the whole red carpet's looking at me, and I'm on the other side of the velvet ropes. So I'm like, I don't know. He's like, I know you. He's turning to this, he was not Alex Turner, he was like a little kid. And I look to his left, and there's Anton, the PR guy for, I was telling you about, with Foo Fighters, Nirvana. He was the press guy for all those dudes. And I look at, I go, Anton. He's like, Christian. And then I was like, you know him? And Anton's like, yeah, it's Christian Stevenson. So Alex jumps over the rope, Channel 5, 10:30, Saturday morning. You're the rad guy. I go, yeah, Christian Stevenson. He's like, yeah, I know who you are. I'm Alex Turner. I go, nice to meet you, Alex. And then everybody's just staring at us, you know, because he's not talking to anybody. And I go, well, it looks like I can get a question. I said, what are you listening to? And he goes, Beyond the Sea. We start seeing Bobby Darin, because he was doing that album with Miles Kane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
Shadow Puppets, and he was really into Bobby Darin.
All that swing. Yeah.
So that was kind of funny. It's really weird that these bands that grew up on Rad, because we would put ads in the NME asking for music. And we go, so we have no budget for music, but we will put your name, your band, and your track, kind of like the way MTV would at the beginning of the video.
Yeah.
That's how we would help promote them.
I think for me, I only remember Sidewalk and Rad as my two exposures within the media to that culture at that time.
Yeah, Sidewalk Skateboard Magazine. Well, it's funny. I love doing podcasts, and thank you for even having me on the show.
My pleasure, dude.
Matt Barr, who was the editor and the writer with Ed Lee on Sidewalk, on White Lines, their snowboard sister magazine, he does one called We Look Sideways. He's just in his 50th one. He interviews the best athletes in action sports. I think he did Lane Beachley recently, who's going out with the drummer from NXS. Like, he tweeted her, and she said yes to it, and they're in Australia. Next thing he's at their house, and the drummer from NXS is making him tea. He couldn't believe his life. Like, oh, my God, I'm going to go to Lane Beachley, and you're in NXS.
Here's an idea for you, dude. Shall we pause here, eat some food, and then come back and talk all about the, you know, food chapter in your career? I think that's a nice little interlude and then springboard for DJ Barbecue and all things K-tertainment, yeah? All right, brother.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There's so much I wanted to talk to you about, but I guess we're a bit pressed on time. I wanted to quickly ask you about the Instagram party that you DJ'd off the back of influencing on social media. So tell us about that and how that came about and the night itself. What happened? What went down?
Jamie Oliver was the second celebrity signed to Instagram after Snoop Dogg. And I was pretty early on to Instagram as well. And I loved it. Back then, it was more like a WhatsApp group. It was that kind of, you know, community-led. It wasn't as big as it is now. But it went nuts. So Jamie had just got me my first book deal. I got a phone call from Penguin saying, hey, we got you a book deal. I go, cool. And I'm thinking I had like, you know, months to write it. And they go, when do you need it? You know, and I'm thinking, you know, hopefully sometime in the winter. And they go, we need it in 2 weeks. I go,
2 weeks?
Yeah, they wanted a book in 2 weeks. They go, I'm on holiday tomorrow to Portugal. I'd rather not write the book while on holiday. I like to spend it with my kids and my family. But I will. They go, as soon as you get back, you have 2 weeks to deliver it. I'm like, okay, on holiday? We were at a pool party. My laptop was playing music. Blew up in the sun. Lost a year and a half of recipes.
Oh, my God. It wasn't backed up.
Nope. Some of it was, but not the majority of it. So I took it to Apple Genius Labs and all that. They couldn't help me. Luckily for me, Jamie Oliver hired the head of Genius Labs to be his head of IT. So the guy's like, well, I'll rebuild this, and I'll give you a new memory board. I'll give you everything, and we'll pay for it. Or you can just wait and try to see what Apple will do. I think I'm going to go with you. And, but the day it was finished was the day that the party. So Jamie said, Christian, Kevin has just sold Instagram for $1 billion to Facebook. We are going to have a party at 15. Can you DJ it? I'm like, well, I'm supposed to be writing this book, and I'm already a month now past deadline. But of course, I'll do it for you. You know, Jamie got me the book deal. So I get there early with my sound system and my spandex.
Two essential ingredients to any DJ barbecue set.
The American flag, which I have stopped wearing ever since Trump got on board. Don't want to win a championship.
Spoiling it for everyone.
Yeah, sorry.
Not you, him.
Sorry about Trump. People will love him, and they hopefully will see the way. Anyway, I looked at the VIP list of who was invited. I'm like, wow, Cheryl Cole, she'll never turn up. Like, you know, Boris Becker. Maybe, you know, this is a total wish list. But I'm forgetting it's Jamie Oliver and the guy who created Instagram. So I get by the decks, I'm starting to play some music, I look up and I'm just like, so many like hot, beautiful women, you know, like they look like they're from California, they were like models and actresses, and then I'm like, well, they must have hired some girls to be here, you know. And then amongst them all, right in the middle, right in front of me on the dance floor, was Jared Leto. And I'm like, Jared Leto's here? Now, I know Madonna and, bless him, Bowie told me to quit name dropping, but Jared Leto's there, right? So I'm like, okay, what do you play for Jared Leto? I think I played Erotic City or something. I tried to work, you know, Controversy by Prince just to be cool. But I had to wee. It's really hard to wee in the spandex because you have to unzip it. So I ran towards the toilets, you know, put a CD on and took it to Remain, you know, so it keeps playing.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
You know how to do it. And then, at the top of the stairwell was David Loftus, who is my photographer. David's photographer just did one of the Middleton's books. And he's like, DJ Barbecue, come here. DJ Barbecue, Pippa Middleton, DJ Barbecue. So I was like, what do you say to Pippa Middleton that no one's ever said to her? So I spun around and I pointed at my zipper, my Pips, can you unzip me, please? Really got to do a wee. So she did, you know, she giggles and unzipped me. And unzipped my spandex. And thank you so much. I ran down the stairs, kind of giggling to myself, unleashed, came back up, and I, you know, realized, you know, maybe I was a bit rude. I go, I'm really sorry about that, Pips. I wasn't trying to be rude. I just really had to wee, and I'm DJing. It's hard. She's like, no, that was a first for me. It was very funny. Can I get a photo? Of course you can. So I get a photo with her and David. And as I'm running away from them to get back to my decks as my song's finishing,
clock's ticking,
I bowl over Ronnie Wood. And he's just cackling at me because here's a tall, long-haired dude in an American flag jumpsuit, you know, running over him. And it ain't that hard to do because he's quite small. And he's like, ah, like the Wicked Witch of the West. He's like, oh, look. And then I'm so sorry, Mr. Wood. And I look to the left and there's Boy George laughing at me. So I get behind the decks and I'm like, there's Jared Leto amongst that throngs of models. And
where do I go next?
Play my next song. Look to my left where the pizza oven is, and there's Boris Becker. And guess who he's talking to? Tiny Tempa. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. When is that going to happen? Instagram story party. Instagram party, not Instagram story. Someday. you know, we ended up drinking all night with James Nesbitt.
Amazing. He likes to cut it loose, right?
Well, I think he and his missus just had the bust up, and he took the entire staff of 15 to Duck and Waffle, ran up a $2,000 bill, and paid for it himself. What a cool guy. I sadly had to get a car back home where I was supposed to start work on the book that hour, and I spent all day in bed with the worst hangover ever. But it was a party. I've never been to one of those like super VIP parties. I didn't believe I would ever be at one, but it was a good one, you know?
It's something amazing about the way people hit a certain level of fame and then they just all mingle together. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're like, you guys would never interact in normal life, but here we are.
I always see the Hemsley sisters like, you're in every issue of Evening Standard and all. You know, who's your publicist to go to all this stuff, you know? But again, I like my lifestyle because when I see my friends, you know, it's backstage at rock gigs or it's, you know, at food festivals and that's my world, is food and rock and roll.
So when did you, obviously you mentioned earlier on that the food's always been there in the family and a part of your life since as long as you can remember. When do you make the transition from being a broadcaster and being involved in extreme sports and predominantly music-based television and radio and make the leap? Because DJ Barbecue is just you. That's not like a character that you've sat down and come up with out of nowhere.
Well, I mean, it's a character I developed that's part of me. So when I was doing all the festivals, I started dressing up and just, you know, do costume changes, dress up like I was in Poison, and next thing I'm dressing up as like a Liberace meets Iggy Pop, you know, kind of character, in white fur coats with spandex, but the face very Alice Cooper. And then I kind of had this epiphany on the banks of Loch Ness. I was doing Rock Ness Festival, and it was like we had a full tent. And the girls started taking their tops off, and the guys started taking their tops off. And I'm looking at all these young people going, what the hell am I going to do when I turn 40? You know, can I keep playing to naked, you know, young 20-something-year-olds? You know, is it weird or is it okay? So that's when I came up with this idea of I'm going to bring my two loves of barbecue and DJing and put them together and create a destination, create a catertainment area. We might come for the food, but you'll stay for the music. We'll just come for the music, you'll stay for the food, and then we keep you there. And it's a destination. And I spent from 2012 to now developing that brand. And now we're the third biggest brand across all social platforms for barbecue. We've got two best-selling books out. I'm writing my third book right now, the burger book. So the barbecue book came out, I think, 4 years ago. Fire Food came out in April.
Was this an Amazon chart topper as well?
Number one. I got the orange badge.
That's incredible, dude. Congratulations.
Thank you. And so it's going really good. I wanted to do with, because I think food books look a bit boring. It's just always a plate of food on a really pretty plate. But I wanted to show the crew around me. You know, we all, you know, my right hand man who wrote the book with me, Chris Taylor.
Go with the big beard.
He just shaved it yesterday.
Oh, man.
See my where's Chris? Anyway, he's in a pirate metal band called Carry On in Basingstoke. And he actually built a double neck flying V bass guitar out of aluminum. It's 30 kilos. He can barely play two songs in it, and he has to put it down. But he just loves, you know,
the showmanship element, the same as you.
Yeah, and again, because half my crew are like, you know, our food's so good, why are you wearing spandex? It's a gimmick. And then the other guys, the rock and roll guys, are like, no, wear spandex. We're fun. Food's supposed to be fun. You know.
What I like as well, dude, is just looking through this book now is obviously there's like a fun element, but you obviously take cooking and specifically barbecue cooking very seriously.
Oh, God, yeah.
And all of the, you know, setup techniques are in here, and there's like everything that anyone who has no idea about barbecuing needs to know to get into it.
From beginners to intermediates to experts, there's something in there for everybody. But it's a great place to start or hone your skills. And I just think there's some adventurous recipes in there because I'm a world citizen and I've traveled the world. I've lived in Portugal, France, Australia, spent time in Pakistan and Japan and you know, just seeing how people cook and I love food. So I was taking little ideas from everywhere and, you know, kind of creating my own recipes. I don't read other books. I don't watch food shows. I just try to keep it fresh.
Keep it pure.
Yeah. Everybody said, why don't you read more books so you get ideas? I'm like, I'd rather just go travel and eat people's food and then get ideas. You know?
There was the dude recently, obviously, who passed away, Anthony Bourdain.
My God.
And he was a real pioneer of that similar idea that food is about bringing people together and it's about experiencing the world through our mutual shared passions and joys and connections. And food is like that one thing, I think, like music, that breaks down barriers.
He was the bon vivant of people travel, new experiences, and also giving line chefs a voice. You know, Kitchen Confidence, which is now luckily back in the top 30, you know, sadly for that reason that he passed away. But he was the purest of all adventurers, not just a food adventurer, but an adventurer. And I've done some pilots with the companies in America. They are trying to pitch me as the next Anthony Bourdain. I go, I don't want to be the next Anthony Bourdain. I don't want to be the next Guy Fieri. I just want to be me and do my kind of thing. Because those guys have done what they do, and they should be applauded for more so Anthony Bourdain. You know, I'm sure Guy is great and everything, but I like Anthony.
He's the master, isn't he? I only recently got into him again, sadly, since finding out about his death, because I'd been aware of him through Asia Argento, because I follow her on Instagram because I love her dad and all his work. And I was like, who's this guy? And then he passed away, and the kind of level of tributes that came out from musicians and artists and all these people.
Did
I was like,
you ever see more tributes on Instagram than for Anthony Bourdain?
Never.
I mean, Prince and Bowie, I saw more for Bourdain, because maybe I follow a lot of foodies, but I saw more posts for him than I did for my biggest heroes, you know, Prince and...
They seemed more sincere and deep rooted within the individuals as well. It seems like he touched so many people with his philosophy.
He gave people in the kitchen a voice, because he exposed how hard it is to be in a kitchen and what happens. And you know, being a chef is hard. Like, it's one of the hard. When we cook, our smoker runs from Thursday at 4 o'clock till Sunday in the evening, and it's 24/7. It's not plugged in. It's airflow. And you know, look, when you and I were sitting here doing the food, I let the chicken get away from me, and there was too much airflow in there, and it was about, 15 minutes overdone. It's still good, but it could have been more perfect, because I wasn't monitoring it, because we got caught up in stories. And I'm not trying to make excuses, but you have to keep an eye on your food. You know, it's not, in barbecue, it's done when it's done.
Yeah.
There's no numbers, there's no precise, you probe your food, you touch your meat, you rub your meat, you know, you feel it, you can use a temperature to see where you're at. And it's just learning how to handle your heat, your fuel. And I just think cooking over live fire is more primal.
I like the way that you embrace that side of it as well. And it's not sanitized, and it's not like everything's all washed down and, you know, perfectly like spotless. Like, you embrace that outdoory element. Even with the photos and the book, like, there's so much stuff of you like outdoors with the kids, with your crew.
Backyard, man.
Is it really? Is that where it's all done?
Shot to show how little that backyard is, because you look at this book, you go, oh my, this is inaccessible. I could never do these recipes, bro. That was all cooked on a 57 Weber Master Touch, the basic backyard kettle cooker, which pretty much everyone has or has access to. That's a decent, cooker. Everything was done there, and so anybody can do this book. Anybody can cook barbecue. It's not something that just the experts can do, because I think once you nail brisket and pulled pork, it's an empowering thing, because these are big frontal muscles that take a long time to slow and low cook to break down the connective tissue so they can self-base from within. And it feels good and empowering. So we've had this insane weather for 2 months. My Instagram on weekends goes apeshit. Just people doing my za'atar spatchcock chicken with a honey glaze, my grilled halloumi, smashed avocado burgers with drizzled with pomegranate molasses, and my dirty baba ganoush, my smacked ribeye, and just seeing all these people attempting these dishes and then nailing them and saying, oh my God, I need your tomato pie. It's life changing. All my friends and family think, I'm the best. Thank you so much. And you're empowering people. And there's no better feeling than that. Other than, I think, being in a band and rocking out a crowd, or being a DJ and entertaining a crowd. You and I get that buzz every time we DJ. I get that buzz every time someone puts a photo on Instagram and says, I did your tomato pie. It was one of the best things I ever had. I didn't think something so simple could be that delicious.
What I love as well that you also do, though, is you acknowledge the fact that you can barbecue all year round. And I've been watching your stuff on YouTube for a few years now, and you'll be out there in the rain. You'll be out there in the cold.
The sunshine.
And you don't need sunshine to barbecue, do you? That is the other thing. Like, obviously, that's the ideal scenario.
No, it's not.
Right.
The best time to cook barbecue is in the fall and in the spring when it's a bit colder. I love cooking barbecue in the winter, man, because that's when I want to stand around hot coals. I do not want to stand around hot coals when it's hot as fuck out.
Makes sense.
That is why do we only stock charcoal, lump wood, and briquettes in the supermarkets from June to September when it's hot as heck? I go on this morning every year on Philip Schofield's show. And,
yeah, yeah.
And they always bring me on the hottest day of the year. And he's like, why is it that we decide to always light the coals up on the hottest day of the year? I'm like, yeah, exactly, Phil. You should be cooking barbecue when it's cold out. That's when I want to be outside and to be warm. But you're right.
So you encourage people to get out there in the winter and
best time to cook.
Embrace the elements.
Otherwise, you're sitting in front of like dumbass reality television.
Love Island or shit like that, yeah. I've only seen the kind of people talking about it online. I've never checked it out, so I don't know the vibe. What is it? Is it gay guys trying to spot the straight guy, or what's the?
No, it's five gay men who go to these dudes' houses and just turn their life around. So one is in charge.
What kind of domesticate them?
No.
Or
so each one is specialized. So one does food. Antoine does food. Bobby Burke's interior design. Camp Camaro. He does the mind. Jesus.
He's your guy.
He is probably my favorite, top five favorite personality out there. When I first saw him, I was like, this guy's annoying. And then you just fall in love with him. He's hair and makeup. Oh, you're going to fall in love with Jonathan. You're going to call me after the third episode. You hate him on the first one. You go, Christian, I think Jonathan is my favorite person in the world.
I get it now.
He is just, because you're a broadcaster and you love quick wit. And to watch someone with that kind of quick wit from you don't know where, and deliver it with enthusiasm and caring, but with humor.
Yeah.
And he's got it. And then I forgot. And then there's one more character. Anyway, they come to these dudes who are kind of maybe setting their ways and, you know, having a hard time. And they turn them around, you know, give them a new look, their house a new look, their mind a new mind. And give them
so it's one of those rare things which is actually like a reality TV show with a positive spin. Yeah. And it's not about laughing at the misfortune or the lack of talent of whatever Joe blogs they're going to bring in off the street, yeah.
No, it's all about empowering. And my girlfriend showed it to me, and I was like, really? I don't really like reality stuff, but it's very well done.
And, there you go.
And next, you know, me and my son Blue, who's in a hardcore punk band, we're rinsing them, you know?
I guess it's like that thing of don't have too much of an elitist attitude towards music, towards television, towards cooking, yep, towards anything. Like, break down those barriers and
I was one of them.
Be less of a snob. Disco.
Whitney Houston, I want to dance with somebody, or disco. And that's where I went. And that's when I realized, Christian, quit being fucking precious about playing cool music. Quit trying to teach him stuff. Quit trying to, like, you know, I love teaching people about good music. And that's what we do as broadcasts. But when it comes to partying and dancing, just give them fucking good party music and get them on the dance floor.
Amen.
And wait till the guys are drunk. You know, before, and the women are drunk, so you can play some of the hits for the guys that the girls won't leave. You know, you don't want to make it too testosterone fuel because they'll leave and then you're screwed.
Yeah, if you keep playing stuff like White Stripes, Save the Nation Army and kind of, you know, testosterone heavy songs, then the dudes are going to take over and the girls are going to leave and then the guys are going to turn around and realize the girls are gone and they're going to leave.
Yeah. That's why I always play Holiday by Madonna. And I want
so
to
good.
Somebody by Whitney Houston. And I feel good for it.
This textbook DJ 101. Dude, I want to finally ask you this kind of question, and I wanted to spend a bit longer on this, but I feel like it's important to raise and bring up. Cooking with meat, and obviously in the kind of culture we're in now with a lot of people, you know, perhaps criticizing people who do work with meat and saying that's cruel. I wonder if you could just shed some light on responsible food sourcing and responsible
sure.
cooking and perhaps address that criticism.
It's a good question because I am known as the meat guy, and it's a title I don't like. That book, Fire Food, 1/4 of it is vegetarian, and over half the recipes people are emulating from the book and repeating are the vegetarian ones. And I'm realizing, wow, the times are changing.
They are, aren't they? In the last 2 to 3 years, like when you started, I don't think it was as much of a thing at all. But in the last 2 to 3 years, it's really risen to the surface of popular consciousness, hasn't it?
Of course. And we do need to go to a plant-based diet. I think, you know, meat should be a treat. But here's the thing. And I've spoken to this with Matthew Pritchard, because he's very ethical. And I'm ethical. And I do not agree with commercial farming. What I do agree with is farms need animals. Animals need farms. You know, farms need these animals. You know, they need their poo, because there's no heavy metals in animal poo. There's heavy metals in our poo, which is why they don't put our poo on food. So animals, you know, that manure helps grow your vegetables. If it wasn't for, you know, our food, you know, vegetarians wouldn't have their food. It's how a farm works. So the way I look at it is farms need animals, animals need farms, and I will eat that animal at the end of their life. You know, give me an animal. I don't like fast raising animals, like, you know, cows 18 months, chickens, you know, 3 or 4 months. The last thing that develops on poultry is the fat content, which is why turkey is always dry as fuck, because you haven't let it live to 6 months. And it's at that 6 month, around that 6 month, where the fat starts to develop, and fat's a catalyst, and fat's flavor. And you can cook a turkey in almost half the time if it's got all that fat in there. So you spend a bit more on a slow growth bird, or your bird has lived a better life, and then I'll eat it. Otherwise, you know, it's just food for food's sake, and it's not ethical. It's just for factory farming. It's just to feed the masses, and I understand that, but we can do that with vegetables. And even vegetables get factory, you know, raised, or not farm, but, you know, it's just, we can do it all a bit better. And one thing we have to watch out for is the bees, because if we don't have bees, we're fucked. And all these pesticides and Monsanto, and, you know, we need to take a hard look on how we look after the oceans, how we look after our farming, if we want to sustain this lifestyle, sustain this planet. So, yeah, we need to, I always say, you know, eat less meat. But when you do eat meat, do make sure it's got traceability, provenance, better quality, if you're going to eat meat.
And is that the case of getting all your meat from the butchers, if possible?
Well, no, because a lot of butchers buy from the markets. I try to buy butchers who buy from farms.
Okay.
So my butcher, Nathan Mills, did all the meat in my book. He owns the butchery in Forest Hill. He's about to open up one in Spitalfields. He sources straight from the farm, so he knows what the animal eats. He knows the farmer. He knows how they're looked after. He likes to buy older animals. Like, he'll find a 10-year-old Dexter. He'll find a 14-year-old Dexter cow that's near the end of his life. Then he'll eat it. But the whole thing with the spine and BS, the whole mad cow disease, I started saying you can't have an animal past 18 months, but you can. You just have to remove the spine the way you do all the meat, and there are a lot of these safety regulations that have harmed our way of being more ethical.
Yeah.
Because of safety reasons, and I understand that, but, you know, a lot of it killed the dairy industry, and a lot of the industry, you know, I stopped doing all dairy. I stopped doing all dairy. I do butter. I think we need certain animal fats. I think we need them. I don't think we should do margarine, but I do butter. I won't do milk. I think milk slows us down, but I do like butter, and I think it's good for us. But I am eating less meat, but I'm eating better quality meat when I do so. It says a man who just served you a roast chicken.
And a man who enjoyed that chicken, and that's probably the sixth time in 2 years that I've eaten meat. And it's nice because you save it for special occasions when it's like a treat. As you say, meat should be a treat. You got to do it, and you got King Lear tonight.
King Lear with Ian McKellen, dude.
Killer.
3 hours. I've been pounding coffee to make it through, dude.
If people want to find out more about you, your work, and where can they get the book, first of all, and then where do they go on the World Wide Web to follow you and keep up to date with what's going on?
Just put DJ BBQ into YouTube, into Google. You'll see the website, which is our web store. So we have signed books there available and merch. But the main thing is the YouTube channel. So we've got over, I think, 300 videos online, free recipe videos on Jamie Oliver's food channel and my DJ Barbecue channel. So everything, indoor, outdoor, you know, live fire, you know, family recipes, crazy stuff. Where I ask my kids, what do you want Dad to make? Let's do a fish and chip waffle. Let's make a cheeseburger rama. There's silly stuff like that. And then really, you know, your classic pulled pork, your classic burgers. And then Instagram, DJ BBQ, and then DJ _BBQ on Twitter. And hopefully you'll see me at a festival sometime and come by for some barbecue. But we have introduced a really big vegetarian menu now.
I love it.
We've gone very big. You know, we've got a smoky chunky chips. We smoke the potatoes first, and we chunk them up and then deep fry them. We've got a...
I love cooking with vegetables, man. I get a real hit off of it.
That's why the book, I think, is popular, because people know how to do burgers. They know how to do steaks, but they're just a bit uncomfortable with vegetables. So
it's that classic thing, isn't it, of, well, what do you have with the vegetables? Because everybody just presumes that vegetables are like a side.
Yeah.
And it's trying to break that mentality and go, well, actually, you can have a delicious, nutritious main course with purely vegetables.
You know, Yotama, I curate and host Meatopia every year, which is a big meat festival. And we headline with Yotama Talengi, the most famous, you know, Middle Eastern kind of chef. And he held up Swede. We're going to slow cook Swede in front of a carnivore crowd. He got booed. But it was a pantomime boo. It was very funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, then, you know, everybody laughed it off. I was like, with the back of my, well, I've never.
Could have gone either way there.
Tomatolangi, you know, one of the most successful food authors and restaurateurs in the world, won't ever get booed on stage, but it happened. And on that stage, we cook 17-year-old dairy cows from the Basque Country. And, you know, an animal, and that's a lot of the Spanish, they believe the animal needs to have a long, happy life. And they're very careful the way they, you know, they slaughter them. You know, there's no mobile phones, there's no mobile phone technology. They're carefully carted away. They don't see it coming because they have lived a long, full life. Now we'll eat them. Otherwise, it's wasteful. You know, in a way, you know, that animal's service purpose is provided, you know, milk and butter and poo for our vegetarian friends' food. And then when it's done, instead of letting it go to waste and rot, I'm going to eat it. And I'm happy with that.
Final question, and then we'll end it. Pick out one recipe in here which you think would be a really good go-to starter for anybody who buys this book and they haven't yet delved into any of the recipes. Could you recommend one?
I can do it.
Yeah? Do you know it off the top of your head?
Yep.
It's
going to be, it's a vegetarian recipe. And it's an Appalachian recipe from my neck of the woods. So my mom was from Virginia Beach. And it's a tomato pie. And it's kind of like leftover food. Like a paella. Paella is a leftover dish. It's like, you know, your aunt or your mom or your grandma goes into the fridge, you know, in Spain somewhere and just pulls everything out and just chucks it in with some rice, the rest of the pork, some prawns that were sitting in there, and just makes a paella. Same thing, you know, bread, you know, day-old bread, tomatoes, some cheese, some mayo, some red onion, and you layer it up like a pie and you bake it, or you put it in your cooker and you cook it indirect. And when you have it, it's such a cheap thing to make. It's so Moorish. That, the dirty baba ganoush, like cooking, you know, aubergine straight on the coals and making the baba ganoush that way, and then the smack ribeye. And I learned that from Neil Rankin. I learned it from Adam Perry Lang. Big fat ribeye. You smack it with a frying pan. You create more surface area. You break open the area around the fat so you can render the fat because the fat's flavor. But there's so many fun recipes in there that I think people get stuck in. But I spent 4 years on that book, and I'm really proud of it. And I should have a new book out by next year called The Burger Book.
Amazing.
So I'm working on that right now. So, yeah, there's my three recipes. And I'll give you a copy of book number one, which is the barbecue book.
Killer. I think anybody listening to this will have just gotten off the tones in your voice and the excitement levels in your voice, how much you engage and love food and cooking. And it's really nice to be in the presence of someone who has so much enthusiasm for it as a craft and an art form. And if people go watch your videos on YouTube as well, they'll see how much fun you bring into the cooking environment. So
thanks
for spreading the joy through food, Christian.
You spread the joy of music and personalities with, you know, you're a fellow broadcaster, and you know, you and I both know broadcasting ain't easy. And it's a fun pursuit. It's not an easy pursuit, but it's in our blood. And there's nothing better than entertaining people through storytelling, through music, through food.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.